It's 8:18. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Snydeville Basin Planning Commission also met last night. On the phone with an update, I have Planning Commissioner B. Peck. Good morning, B.
Good morning, Leslie.
First up was a public hearing with regard to the Commons at New Park, the final subdivision plat. This is for a 7-unit condominium project there. What did the Planning Commission decide?
We voted a recommendation. We made an approval of that project with a few conditions, which really had more to do with some aesthetics on the face of the building on Main Street and aesthetics having to do with perhaps a retaining wall or some of the wall treatments on the amphitheater side. But a lot of that will be left up to the discretion of the planning staff, the director of development, and the architects and the applicant.
So where's the final location of this? Was it as just the most recent development with regard, you know, kind of flipping it on the other side of the amphitheater?
Yeah, they did flip it, and yes, that's the iteration that we went with the front doors facing Main Street and the garages facing the amphitheater with a small private lane on that side.
Okay. And in terms of just the impact on the amphitheater, there was concern that, you know, what was a great public space would kind of be diminished. Do you feel that you've reached the best compromise here?
Sure. The amphitheater is still intact. We did go through a series of studies on the shadowing effect, and the applicant, by flipping the building, was trying to address, and I think did address, some of the perception concerns that it would be looming or towering, and some of those concerns that it would be, you know, too much of a big wall. So they, by flipping it and graduating the floors of the condos, the effect is lessened. They also have staged them a little bit differently, so it's not a straight horizontal line, which adds a little more room, or at least to the perception of the amphitheater. So we're satisfied. They made every effort. We liked the flip design, if you will, and I think that hopefully alleviates some of the concerns that we heard from the public on the visual impacts.
Yeah, the Planning Commission then also agreed to remove the one affordable housing unit in it, what, to try and make it smaller, huh?
Well, they weren't required to do that in the first place because the affordable housing requirements had already been satisfied by New Park. They had offered to do it, but with the reconfiguration and the flipping of the design, that basically bumped out or didn't leave room for the unit. So best intentions, but in order to accommodate moving the building off of the amphitheater and closer to Main Street, that had to be sacrificed.
Yeah, there were lots of critics of this project proposal of what was originally intended as a one-story restaurant. I mean, it was never determined that that's what it had to be. But I guess I'm just after all is said and done here, the fact that there was a lot of public outcry over it, did it make a difference in the Planning Commission's approval?
Well, it certainly made a difference that the applicant was willing to go through a number of designs and then the ultimate flipping of this. So I think the applicant was very responsive to the public demands. The truth of it is that they had the legal right to do it. They were in compliance with their development agreement. And there's not a lot that Planning Commission can do when it's basically a conditional use permit in there, but then they're within the restrictions. The guidelines were that, guidelines. There were specific terms within the development agreement that gave some flexibility, but according to market changes, the owner, developer of that property could put in changes and do something different. So, yeah, I think it had there had been talk and discussion that it could be a restaurant, but it could be residential too, all along. So I think the developers just tried to make the best decision they could and to be as responsive as they could be to the public's concern about the use and look and feel of the amphitheater, and we're satisfied they put their best efforts forward.
All right. Later on was a public hearing, possible action regarding the condominium plat for a previously approved 68-unit multifamily development known as Quarry Springs. This is on the southwest corner of Kilby Road and Pinebrook Boulevard. What happened here?
Well, that was a consent agreement, and that kind of went into the works in 2011. So we really didn't have any, we had no leeway at all if we had any specific concerns. Everything was according to the plan, according to the consent agreement. So this was just the final check of the box.
Okay. Anything else from last night's meeting you wanted to mention?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your time, Bea.
Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Bea Peck. News time, 8:24.
This is Dirk Beal with Deer Valley Resort, a sponsor of the Winter Pledge Drive on KPCW. I love KPCW because of the Nordic Trail Report. I enjoy tuning in before I catch first chair in the morning. Help KPCW keep fresh tracks on the air all year long. Donate to the Winter Pledge Drive starting on Monday, February 26th.
It's 8:25 now. Good morning. Well, on Monday, the People's Health Clinic celebrated their opening in Heber City with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. It's a women's only clinic established to serve Wasatch County residents. It comes about 8 months after Planned Parenthood closed their Heber City office. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more on this.
The People's Health Clinic provides no-cost medical services to uninsured residents of Summit and Wasatch counties. Executive Director Beth Armstrong says the facility in Heber will be open every Monday morning from 9 to noon, with plans to expand hours to a full day as soon as it is needed.
If we need to add more time, we will. We're completely committed to serving the Wasatch community. The clinic that we're offering right now will be a women's-only clinic. So we'll be providing prenatal care for the most part, and it's going to be at the hospital. If you walk into the hospital at Heber, it'll be in Suite D, which is down the hall and to the left.
Armstrong says they're fully staffed with an OBGYN physician and a physician's assistant. At this point, it's a women's health clinic providing mostly reproductive services.
We'll be doing breast screenings, and we'll do PEPs, and we'll do reproductive education, and their prenatal and ongoing, of course, we'll just schedule them out for all their prenatal visits. We'll provide other services, and then, like I said, when we see the need, then we'll expand those. I would love to continue to see it the same as the clinic here in Park City, how we went from 3 days to 5 days whenever we saw that the need existed. Hopefully we'll be able to do the same thing in Heber.
Dr. Christopher Cook practices out of the Heber City Hospital and volunteers his services to the People's Health Clinic. With the new location, he'll be able to see his Wasatch patients without traveling to Park City. Armstrong says 80% of missed appointments at the clinic in Park City are caused by transportation issues.
I just truly believe that it will make some of these women who have to take, you know, a day or a half a day off work, load up the kids, put them in the car and come and sit and wait in a waiting office. It'll make their lives just a little bit easier. And, you know, if we can, we should.
For an appointment at the new Heber office or at the Park City Clinic, call 435-333-1850. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
There's no place quite like Park City, and that's why we support local morning news with KPCW. All Seasons Resort Lodging provides nightly rental management and HOA services to care for your Park City property, as well as marketing and property maintenance. More information at allseasonsresortlodging.com.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud KPCW supporter.
KPCW News Time now, 8:28. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Council meets in a study session starting at 4 o'clock Thursday with the annual joint meeting with the Library Board. That'll be followed by a review of the city's five-year housing plan, as well as a tentative settlement of the Treasure Hill development. In the studio with details, I have Park City Manager Diane Faster along with Assistant City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start off real quick, Diane, with the housing plan. This is something that's required by the state. Anything in the report that you think is newsworthy? I mean, it seems like we've talked about stuff before, staying on top of those 800 units by 2026, the completion of the units at Park Avenue and the Central Park locations very soon. We've got a construction agreement for 12 units at Woodside Park, and then a design team already underway working for phase two of Woodside Park and the Homestake lot.
I think there are just a couple of highlights. One is that, and these aren't surprising, but with median age continuing to rise, as well as about 8,000 of our workforce within the city, about 85% come from outside the city. And no surprise to anyone, with the median house price up to about $1.6 million, as the report states, middle management and upper management at companies and in government can't even afford to live in the city. And so that's going to become increasingly a problem. And we already know that about 70% of our housing stock, or including condo rooms, are second homes. And we're just going to continue to slide. And so that's a big piece of the report, as well as the report does talk specifically about the need for affordable rental units. And that is particularly challenging for our city council, because as soon as you put money into affordable units, you know, let me describe something differently. When you build an affordable home that you sell, you recoup a lot of the money. So you don't recoup 100% of the cost, but however much you decide to discount that property, you do get funds back, and then you can build more. As soon as you build rental product, you're getting a very low income stream back. And so that's a super challenge for the city. However, we do recognize the need for it.
So there are at least no plans for the next 5 years in terms of rental housing.
That's not necessarily true. The city council looks at it every time they build a project. They look both at do they want to do any rental as part of it. They also look at what area median income do they want to target. And one of the things that folks don't know is they say, "Oh, affordable housing. Why don't you get federal help?" Well, because of our population and because of the high area median income. It doesn't mean everyone makes that, but it does mean we're not eligible for federal dollars.
All right. You'll also get an update from Park City's parking consultant on the demand-based parking system that went into effect December 15th. I'll be talking with both Kenzie Colston and the consultant Julie Dixon on Friday. But what's your initial reaction? I mean, with I think a month's worth of data, is it working, and we're able to find parking downtown when we want it?
I think the two things that I noticed out of this report is, one, and I think this is just a general observation that a lot of folks have, is that our parking system is working really well. Sure, you hear about, oh, you know, we have video of somebody lifting up a gate, or there was somebody who drove through the gate, was really drunk, and we hear about those types of things. But, you know, talking to folks who were around when Park City Mountain Resort first put gates in their underground parking, that's pretty normal. And we know that from around the country. That's pretty normal with a new system. The reality is it's working. People aren't doing laps in the garage to try to find parking. Homestake during Sundance was packed every day. The park and rides were packed. And so great parking program. And the wonderful thing now is we do have a new staffer, Robbie Smoot, and he is the first person whose entire job is focused on data. So he's a data analyst. He understands data mining. He's got a breadth and depth of experience. And if you go into the report, you can actually see great numbers. And basically, it's evidence-based that our parking system's working.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Homestake parking lot. I mean, on the busiest day during Sundance, 331 people actually taking transit from the lot to Old Town. The average is more like about 125. So when we think about that lot, I mean, I guess it's going to be moved anyway, maybe not next year, but in years to come. And it's only, I mean, really impacting maybe a couple of hundred people.
Sure, but you take a few hundred cars out of China Bridge and you've now created parking availability. And the reality is there are some days where employees will bring their cars into China Bridge and there are other days they'll park at Homestake. And our plan is by the time we close that lot down, because that is planned to be affordable housing, we will have the Richardson Flat Park and Ride lot open. And we will have some way, we don't know if it's going to be an HOV lane or something else, we're still going through that process with both the state and the feds. We will have a way for a bus to get in from Richardson Flats really quickly and really frequently.
And lots of carpool permits have been issued. And are we seeing that work as it's supposed to? Or
People are using carpool permits, and it's great. And it might be that they're leaving a car at Richardson Flats or picking up a friend at a house, but we're seeing a lot of carpool permits. And if you look at the data, we see the arrival time for a lot of folks on Main Street as 3 p.m. And if you have a friend and you can pick them up on the way, they have very predictable, most typically, they have very predictable hours.
Deer Valley Drive, a pedestrian and biking access between Bonanza Drive and Marsac Roundabout, a study is being done. Where are we on this?
So City Council, this was a request of City Council. Some of it came out of the discussion of Airy Drive and a pedestrian overpass. And one of the things that folks notice, you see it especially during Sundance, is people may not know about the Poison Creek Trail or that Google may not suggest to them that they go that way. And so you sometimes see pedestrians on Deer Valley Drive or you see them kind of trudging through the snow along the side of Deer Valley Drive. So we've got that project underway. This is just an update. We're not done yet. And working with the state on that one, where it is a state road.
So are we talking about perhaps paving the dirt trail that we now have that's just accessed, Lost Prospector, I guess is what it's known as?
I don't think you'll see just because of, like dogs, we do put trails first. I think you're more likely to see something on the other side of the road, some type of path being put in there.
All right, if possible. Right. And that's what we're studying, whether or not there's even room.
Exactly.
UDOT has wanted Park City to take ownership of 224, at least that section of it, for years. Are you still resisting that?
Well, I think one of the pieces is if we take over that piece, are we going to take I don't think the city would actually have a problem if it were just between Bonanza and the roundabout. The issue is the piece of road from the roundabout up past the Montage is quite an expensive piece of road to maintain. We've looked at it, and it would actually, just to snowplow there, it would double our $1.5 million snowplow budget to take over that small section of road.
A personal injury case settlement for $100,000. This was a woman hit by a snowplow back in 2013. The city's just settling now, huh?
The city is just settling now. This has gone through a lot of process and a lot of evaluation, and the city has looked at this and said, there's a lot of pieces in this that we don't necessarily agree with. The plow driver has since is of an age where he passed away, and so we don't have a witness, and we don't believe we have a great case in court. So we think the city council's fiduciary responsibility, we're recommending to them that they settle this because we think in the end it will be cheaper than litigating it.
Okay. And finally, I wanted to note that staff directing council to sell nearly 2.5 acres. This is property at the healthcare center to the fire district for $1 million. And that's being done why?
That's being done. You know, we've been talking to the fire district about whether we want to give them a 99-year lease at a low cost or whether they want to own the property. I believe the feedback we got from the fire district and the fire board was that the county council has a preference of owning land and they would prefer that. So the city is looking at selling part of this property and to have a fire station out there, which is a huge public service, and we really appreciate and value our partnership with the fire district. As part of this as well, and I believe it's stated in the agreement, that the city will be able to have a small police presence out there, so not a full police station. But it is important, particularly during times of high traffic, that we are able to put people in various places. And we won't necessarily have someone there full time, but the ability to station somebody there during Sundance, for example. And also to store a mobile command post there. We're space constrained in the city, and we want to be able to store it a little bit outside.
Yeah. And what do we do with $1 million? Where does that go?
That's a fine question. I actually don't know what account that would go back into. my guess is City Council would have the ability to direct those funds, and I think everything we're hearing right now is that City Council wants to be able to find more money for housing.
Okay, let's turn it to you, Matt Dias. Treasurer, what's new in the agreement here, if anything?
Well, I think what's new is we spent the last 2 weeks, we had several open houses with the community, soliciting feedback. City Council members and the mayor and staff have met, I think, to this point with almost 100 individuals getting their feedback. But as far as the deal itself, I mean, the deal is relatively straightforward, and councils and the mayor have done their best to maintain it that way, which is a $64 million purchase and sale agreement to buy the entire property, to retire all of the density and development that was planned for that hillside once and for all.
You've had questions at those open houses about an appraisal, and has one been done recently? What's the answer to that?
Well, I think the answer to that is we're comfortable with the valuation. We've been working on this kind of institutionally for, gosh, I'd say almost 30 years, but particularly the last 10 years, and I think it's fair to say it began sort of with Dana Williams when council took themselves out of the process and went to the negotiating table. And so we've had sort of a decade now of back and forth valuations of the lands, working with real estate investors and appraisers and getting kind of a valuation. But at the end of the day, this was the best deal that we were able to bring to the voters. So we are not presenting a true valuation in the purchase and sale agreement, but I think at this point it's the best deal that we could get, and we think it's fair, and right now we're recommending approval.
Okay, so it's basically we take your word for it that it's worth that much, or really it doesn't matter because that's what the owner wants, and it's like it's this or nothing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different ways of looking at it, and we've received a lot of good feedback about this. But, you know, the previous plan was a $30 million buy down for half of what was going to go on that hillside. And so some people just sort of do the math and double it. Other people understood that the previous plan had 18 single-family home lots. And do the math on an old town single-family home lot for a couple million dollars times 18, and you can get there pretty easily. But there's a lot of different ways of looking at this.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about there's a couple of houses that have been developed, but we're talking about seven other lots up there, 1 and 2. 3 and 4, 6 and 7, and lot 8. What happens to those? I mean, does the Sweeneys, they retain those lots?
They would, and I'm not sure actually all of them are still with the Sweeneys. I think some of them have been sold. Mm-hmm. But the plan is we would retire all of the additional density for the 63 acres that were part of the Creole Gulch and the additional kind of commercial and residential. Now, there are a few other parcels up there. Most of them have been built out, and that is a single-family density that's up on that hill. So there are a few parcels up there that will retain their single-family density, but those are outside of this deal.
Most of them have been built? I thought just 2 of the 7 have been.
I believe it's 5 of the 7, okay. But I'd have to check. But that's my understanding, and that's outside of this deal.
And just to add one piece, Matt talked about that on the density. I think that's one of the questions City Council wants to hear from the public about is whether to retire 100% of the density and keep some of it, or keep some of it to be able to transfer it. And Matt can talk about what percent's available, and that's a question that City Council has for the public.
Yeah, we've heard 22 units, right? I mean, that's the max density that could be transferred, if in fact the city decides to do that.
That's correct, yeah. And that would be a council decision, and I would anticipate that they would likely, you know, signal the direction that they're headed in that on Thursday night, that they'd prefer to retain that decision or allow a future council to make that decision. And that's a decision that has to be made before the Planning Commission. So if a decision like that was made in 2 years or 10 years, that would be a legislative process where we would have to go before the Planning Commission, have public hearings, take public input. So there'd be significant public feedback before anything like that was done.
What about the agreements between the resort, Vail Resorts, and the landowner, which we would now be the landowner? I mean, we're parties now to those agreements that have to do with the town lift and tram agreements. Do those agreements need to be public now so that we know what we are getting into in terms of future obligation?
And by and large, they will. But we've been working very closely with, obviously, the resort, and they've been very cooperative, and the Sweeneys. But we are, by and large, the seller has agreed to limit our exposure in terms of any future financial obligations, and we are really just taking over kind of the most narrow application of those agreements in terms of ski access, ski runs, and then kind of the aerial easements for lift alignments or lift upgrades in the future. We don't have any further obligations with the base of the lift there. that the Sweeney family would still retain and own and operate in conjunction with the resort. So both entities have been very, very cooperative in terms of narrowing the city's obligations there.
And I guess I'm just asking is, like, are we on for more money in the future?
Great question. No, we are working to have no financial obligations. And most of those agreements would have been triggered by the additional residential or commercial density. There were certain triggers in those agreements when that project was built over time in a phasing way that lift upgrades would have to be made or people movers. Now that all that density will be retired and will not be used up there, those triggers go away.
All right. And I was going to just add that we had heard from Planning Director Bruce Erickson say that the planning staff would basically do anything we would need to do in order to facilitate future lift improvements.
Council's been very, very strong on this one in particular, that they have no intention of disrupting the ski experience there. They think it's critical to Old Town, critical to the historic district. It's something that makes us very, very unique here in Park City, and we intend to maintain that.
Okay, and just real quick on the cost, we're talking about now for a primary homeowner, about $77 for every $100,000 of taxable value. So if a home's market value is $1 million, the taxable value would be $550,000, right? So that's what we figure it on?
Approximately, yes.
Okay. So we're talking about maybe $400 a year as opposed to $800 a year for that.
For a secondary homeowner.
For a primary homeowner, right? So 55%, right? 77 times 100,000 times 5.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that what we're figuring?
That's right. So the average...
We're talking taxable value, though. We're not talking about market value.
No, true. That's very, very important because there's obviously kind of three different valuations that we've been discussing with the public, and kind of the first and highest is always the market value, and that's what fluctuates the most. The next would be your assessed value, and the assessor comes along every 5 or 10 years and makes an assessed value, and that obviously can't keep up with the volatility of the market value. And then your assessed value is whether you're a primary resident or whether you're a secondary resident or a business owner, and that's your taxable value. So
okay.
That's correct.
Guys, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And checking in with us from Pyeongchang, South Korea, Tom Kelly with U.S. Ski and Snowboard. Good morning, Tom.
Well, good morning, Leslie. And we've still got winter here. How's Park City?
We got some sun shining, but we're looking for some snow later, so that's good news. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the weather because that's really kind of played some havoc in terms of the schedule.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, it has been windy, and wind is something that we do deal with in our sport pretty frequently on the World Cup Tour, but it's been pretty continual here, so it has impacted competitions. Interestingly enough, it's actually impacted some of the technical events, the slalom and giant slalom for the women and the men's downhill. So those schedules have been collapsed quite a bit. So far, we have just one alpine event in. That was the men's combined race, which was held the other day. Ted Ligety finishing fifth in that. And then today, we lost the women's slalom again. That was pushed to Friday. So hopefully tomorrow, we're going to get some alpine underway. We've got the women's giant slalom. That is taking place at Yeongpyeong Resort. And we have the men's downhill, and that will be in Jungsion Resort, about 45 minutes south. So fingers crossed, the winds will subside a little bit, and we can get some alpine ski racing in.
Sorry to read that Tommy Biesmeier out with an ankle injury, huh?
Yeah, we've had two injuries in the last 2 days, actually both of them fairly similar, completely different teams. Rosie Mankari from Anchorage, a snowboard cross athlete, suffered an injury to both her right and her left ankle when she crashed during training and did kind of a forward face plant on the snowboard cross course over at Phoenix Park. And then today in a kind of an open downhill training session that they held, not all of the racers taking part, particularly those, though, that did not get a chance to ski in the combined downhill the other day, were out on the course. Tommy Biesmeier, one of them, and unfortunately he crashed and suffered a fairly similar injury to his right ankle. He will be scratched from the downhill tomorrow. His place will be taken by Ryan Cochran Siegel. So we still will field four in that event, but it will also take him out of the Super G on Friday. Really a tough loss, a first-time Olympian who is really quite well-prepared and has had some good results lately, but unfortunately he will be watching from the sidelines.
Oh, yeah, and just, I mean, he's had lots of injuries in the last 5 years, so that's sad to hear. Let's talk snowboarding, though, because there's some great news there.
Yeah, it's been just remarkable over at Phoenix Park over the last 3 days. Four medals so far in snowboarding, and the U.S. winning all four of the snowboarding events. Red Gerard and Jamie Anderson picking up titles in the slope-style snowboarding event, and Chloe Kim and Ariel Gold picking up gold and bronze in the women's halfpipe. And then today in an event that was just out-and-out warfare, back and forth and back and forth, and in the end, Sean White coming up huge on his last run to take his third gold medal. 12 years from his first gold until this one. Never happened before for an athlete, and quite an amazing accomplishment for him to come back after the trauma that he had in Sochi in finishing fourth in that event. A great accomplishment for Sean White today down at Phoenix Park.
Yeah. And let's see, we've got some cross-country coming up.
Cross-country coming up. First of all, we had the sprint race yesterday. This was one of the top events for the USA. No medal, but Jesse Diggins absolutely in the hunt right down to the final stretch in the Women's Classic Sprint. Three Americans finishing in the top 12. That has never happened before. Sophie Caldwell, Sadie Bjornsson, and, of course, Jesse Diggins finishing in sixth place. Now, all eyes right now are on Jesse Diggins again tomorrow. This will be her probably best shot at a medal, the 10-kilometer freestyle. This is an individual start event. It gets underway at about 5:30 time here, and that's going to be after midnight back in Park City, or early morning hours, but urge you to get up and watch that one if you're a cross-country fan, because she does have a legitimate chance in this one.
Okay, let's see. Anything else you want to mention?
No, pretty well catches us up on the main events, just still waiting for Michaela Schifrin to get that first start anyways. And then, you know, one other interesting accomplishment, Sean White today, and folks may have heard that he won the 100th gold medal for Team USA in the Winter Olympics going back to 1924. Coincidentally, it was also the 100th ski and snowboard medal of any color scored by an athlete since 1924, so a momentous occasion for Sean White today. But going well so far. Snowboarding has been excellent, and just trying to get those alpine events underway. Women's aerials coming up on the freestyle side to Ashley Caldwell, Kylie McKinnon, Kelly and company will be getting ready to go in their qualifying on Thursday, and then they've got their medal event coming up on Friday evening. Maddie Olson, the other one from Park City, competing there, and then the men will be taken to the jumps this weekend.
Okay. Gosh, I'm confused now about the medals. I've seen so many reports about this. I'd heard it was the 100th gold medal.
Well, it's both. It's the 100th gold medal for Team USA across all sports, and it's the 100th medal of any color for a skier or a snowboarder. So kind of two completely separate counts that came together, and you know, just a great accomplishment for Sean to get that gold medal, which was the 100th. Of any Winter Olympic athlete and the 100th ski and snowboard medal. So good show by Sean today.
Okay. Tom, thanks. NPR's On the Media co-host Bob Garfield will present his new one-man show, Ruggedly Jewish, Saturday night on the Eccles stage. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
You're an author, a journalist, a co-host of an award-winning public radio program, and what, now also an actor?
I live to be on the stage. Yeah, so now I'm an actor. I am standing up, bearing everything in front of a crowd of strangers for reasons that I can't quite explain, but I'm you know, going around the country doing it. So here we are.
Yeah, well, tell us about the show. The promotional materials say you're not very rugged and not especially Jewish.
Well, I guess that's true, which might make the title problematic or sort of get to the crux of the issue, because the show is about me trying to figure out who I am, but more broadly about everybody trying to figure out who they are, and even more specifically about America at this particular moment trying to figure out what it is. And it weaves a number of narrative threads, and one of them is my own adult lifelong struggle to come to terms with my religion and my culture, which somehow I fit in the same show with a lady who thinks she has a talking cat and Trumpism. So there's a little bit of everything, plus some singing and dancing and freeze-dried pets.
Yeah. So is it a monologue, or, I mean, does it change based on the week's news? Or
It's a monologue. There is one performer. It's me. I'm definitely definitely the best one on stage, and it does not change with the week's news. No, it is a set piece, and it is I would say evolving somewhat as I go from city to city and learning what is most effective on stage and what is least effective. But essentially, I'm doing the same thing in Park City that I did in Philadelphia and New York and in Chicago and so on.
Yeah. So why is this something you wanted to do? I mean, this is, right, just something new and different, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's part of it. It's something new and different. I don't jump out of airplanes, so I get my seek my thrills in other ways. But it just seemed to be time. These are things that I've been thinking about for decades. Not only as an individual, kind of trying to figure out what my place in the world is, but as a commentator and a critic, a social and critic and media critic, looking at the identity politics that has so polarized our country. And also in my experience as a roving features correspondent for All Things Considered in the 80s and 90s, when I went from city to city finding people who themselves were on a quest to figure out their own personas, mainly by trying to do something kind of spectacular and locate the American dream. So and that was a bit of a freak show because people took very, very strange routes to trying to establish their own self-image. So you take all those elements, and all of a sudden they coalesced, and now seem to be the time to try to figure out what each of those elements says individually, and how together they help us get to the root. Everybody, both me on stage as you watch this odyssey in progress, and the audience in their seats, try to get a fix on their relationship with the rest of the world. So yeah, all of the above.
Yeah. So we offer student tickets. I'm just wondering what's your guess in terms of an age appropriate for this?
Well, it's above 15 because
okay.
I curse. But let me put it to you this way. I had a conversation with a woman at Hillel, which is a cultural organization for Jewish students. And she says that she wishes every Jewish student in the world gets to see this because in the end, and without giving you too much of a spoiler here, it allows people to practice, to be Jewish in any way they see fit. And so, you know, I would say 18 and up, but, you know, it's equally significant, I think, to people who have struggled with these same issues of self-image and identity their whole lives. So, you know, I would say any adult. And by the way, my story is about finding my Jewish identity, but it's like Levy's Jewish rye bread. You don't have to be Jewish to enjoy it. It is about figuring out who you are as a person and as a country and everything in between. So, yeah, I would say everybody.
Great. Well, we saw your co-host Brooke Gladstone in Salt Lake a few years ago. We're glad to see you in Utah. Now, again, showtime is 7:30 p.m. this Saturday. Tickets start at $29. And Bob Garfield will be on stage. Thanks for your time this morning. Look forward to it.
Thank you for yours. I hope everybody has a lot of laughs. It's a fun evening.
Okay. It's Bob Garfield.